Hello and welcome to Season 6 of Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is a multi-Grammy and Emmy Award-nominated comedian, writer, actor, filmmaker, and podcaster. You may know her from Star Trek or The Morning Show, perhaps her best-selling memoir I'm Just a Person, or the documentary on her life Tig, or perhaps from her incalculable talk show appearances, but she is first and foremost an astonishing comedian. A true artist of stand-up, continually pushing bits and pushing boundaries to advance all of our understandings of quite what one can do and achieve with stand-up comedy. As we discuss and is mentioned in virtually every introduction given to her, she has suffered more hardships and misfortunes than many of us could fathomably bear. And yet she has not only survived them all, but turned unrelenting darkness into Hall of Fame-level comedic joy with a unique talent of crafting material that resonates, connects, and uplifts people at every possible point in their lives. She is a creative genius, and a couple of days before her birthday, we sat down over Zoom to talk. Fun fact, a few hours before the call was due to take place, after months of preparation and fixing a date during her promotional tour of her latest special, Hello Again, my area of North London was plunged into a total power blackout. Not a switch in the neighbourhood turned on. Well, I say fun fact, more worst case scenario for me, but miraculously, after 45 minutes of uncertainty, the lights came back on and I could make contact with Los Angeles. And this is what happened. So please, welcome my guest for the Season 6 premiere episode of Spieling the Beans, the one and only, Tig Notaro. Tig, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, happy birthday for Sunday.
If Wikipedia is to be believed.
If what?
If Wikipedia is to be believed.
Yes, yes. I'm going to be 53 on the 24th.
How are you celebrating?
Well, I'm doing a private screening of my new stand-up special that's coming out. And so that's going to be screened at Largo here in Los Angeles. And I'm just having friends and family. My kids are going to go, which I'm very excited about.
Fantastic. You've got such a great connection with Largo as well. Mm-hmm. Which we'll cover over the course of the conversation, but the new special is, of course, Hello Again.
Yes,
it is fantastic. I was privileged enough to see it live, of course, because we met when my girlfriend Mary opened for you for the UK dates.
Yes,
she says hello. By the way, she's currently making a bolognese.
Oh, okay.
But Hello Again is a phenomenal triumph. And Stephanie, your wife, directed you for it.
Yes.
How did you find that arrangement? And how do you... Because by all accounts, it seems quite a joyful, creative collaboration between you two.
Yeah, we met, 12 years ago or something, working on an independent movie, playing love interests. And it wasn't, for another, 6 or 9 months after that, that we became involved. And so we started out working together and we've continued working together. We have a production company, we produce things. We co-directed a movie called Am I Okay, which stars Dakota Johnson. We did that together. We've created shows, we've written together. We have a show actually at Largo right now called She Said, She Said, where we just talk about our lives and kind of bring in the audience to see who connects with my side of our relationship or Stephanie's side of the relationship. Her directing my special just felt very natural. And we do get kind of the response of, oh, and how did that go? but we prefer to work together.
Amazing. Well, yeah. What do you... Because I'm outside of podcasting, I'm a director myself, and I'm always interested mm-hmm. in what performers want their directors to be like. What do you look for in a stand-up director, and is that different from when you're an actor?
Well, I mean, I haven't really. I think I've directed my last couple of specials, and then I had an animated special that a director that's very specific to animation was used and made sense. But I think it's really somebody to facilitate my vision and anything I don't really have a vision about to be able to bring ideas to me that would be helpful. But I would say the majority of the work of a director in a stand-up special is sitting in the editing bay.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, certainly you're along for the whole process, but it does feel like you're facilitating the stand-up. And that's why directing my own specials seems to make the most sense. And because Stephanie and I are always together and working on things, it was, you know, the closest thing to me working on it.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. In Hello Again, you have a section on mishearing, and
yep.
mishearing particularly in relation to a potentially make-believe lounge. And I don't know if you remember, but after we met, we had drinks afterwards, you mentioned during your conversation that you were a bit of a germaphobe post-COVID, and I offered you some hand gel. I don't know if you recall what mishearing happened there.
No,
yeah, I
did. Okay, so I can absolutely cut this out if I mangle it. But we have a very nice conversation. We get up and you mentioned that you're slight germophobic. And I say, would you like some hand gel? And you go very serious and quiet. And you go, oh, no, thank you. Another pause. And then you apparently it heard me ask if you would like a hand job. And I'd like to clarify that... that, once again, was not my intention.
I believe you. I believe you. Well, first of all, I believe that that happened. And second of all, yes. That I don't remember that. But that sounds about right.
Sure. Also in Hello Again, you make good use of a piano, despite the fact that you're not massively au fait with the instrument. Mm-hmm. Where did the idea of playing about on the piano come from? Where was the origin of that?
Well, I mean, I tell a story about how I played the piano at a party in Los Angeles with a lot of celebrities at this party that were going up and performing on stage throughout the evening. And Adele was one of the people that was at the party. And everybody was speculating that she was going to get up and perform and that she would be next. And here she comes. And I think she's getting close to the stage and oh my gosh, psh, 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 here comes Adele, 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 Adele. And then she never performed. And so I got up at the party and performed Adele's Hello. And so when I started telling that story on stage, there was a piano at Largo and I just thought, well, I'll just go ahead and reenact what happened at that party. And now, you know, well, not now, I finished my tour, but during my tour, it was, you know, it's the closing bit.
Sure.
Yeah.
It seems reminiscent of a few years ago, you did a set on Conan involving a stool. And you talk about how you were doing a show in, I think it was Seattle, and you moved the stool, yeah, and you get got a good reaction. And you pushed the bit as far as you could to sort of oscillate how much people found it funny and then didn't and then found it funny again. And it seems to be a recurrent sort of theme through your work of the delight in A, how far you can push an idea, and B, just the sublimeness of the ridiculous. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, very fair. Very fair. Oh my gosh. I love to do that. And I have to be, you know, I have to be amused on stage in order to make sure the audience is amused. So, yeah, that amuses me. And it, I know, drives some people nuts. But, you know.
That's a great barometer to have, that if you're having a good time, or unless you're having a good time, do you feel like, oh, if I'm not enjoying it, maybe the audience isn't?
For sure. Yeah, I think it's better for everybody. If I'm walking on stage like, oh, this is going to be fun, or funny, or I can't wait to do this, or can't wait to see how this goes. And yeah, I think people can feel that kind of excitement and whatever.
Yeah, the joy of the ridiculousness. Looking back over the whole breadth of your career, it does seem to be such a sort of core thread. In your excellent autobiography, you talk about obviously your relationship with your mother, and one thing that really stuck out is how funny she was and how much she delighted in the ridiculousness. And I remember there's reference to blue potatoes.
Yes, mashed potatoes. Yeah.
If you could tell us what happened with the blue potatoes as a great encapsulation of perhaps where this love of the ridiculous comes from.
Yeah, my friends would come over and my mother would say, "Oh, do you want to invite Michelle to stay for dinner?" And so I would, and then when I'd come down to eat, my mother would, whisper like, "Oh, I dyed the mashed potatoes blue, and let's see how Michelle responds to that." And so that was the environment I was raised in, where we would all sit down to dinner and the mashed potatoes are blue, and nobody in my family is reacting to it, and we're waiting for our guest to see what that response is going to be. So there's no doubt that I was influenced by my mother's sense of humor, her sensibility. She was very much somebody into pranks and doing ridiculous bits and stuff. So for sure.
It seems such a great coping mechanism too, to find levity in places that otherwise it's hard to find. I recall how the Largo set that went truly viral, properly viral, old school viral, came of course after the worst year anyone could have, which I'm sure listeners will be very aware of what you went through then. And then it was this final hit essentially of getting the diagnosis that you talk about in the documentary, and I believe in the autobiography as well, about how it seems so ridiculous that you couldn't help but kind of see it as this is so dire it's funny now. There doesn't seem to be a question naturally forming from that, other than does this track the sort of like this feeling of the love of the ridiculousness that you grew up with being there for you when you need it the most?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't find it ridiculous right when I was diagnosed with
Sure.
invasive cancer,
Sure.
but I was stunned.
Yeah.
But as time went on, it felt to be so unbelievable to me because, yeah, I'd had pneumonia, C. diff, which is a intestinal disease. My mother tripped and hit her head and died. My girlfriend and I broke up, and then I got diagnosed, and that was all in like 4 months. And I just, it seemed, yes, very ridiculous in a whole other way.
Totally. It is such a beautiful and monumental work of art that Largo set.
Thank you.
And it was, of course, I'm already thinking Largo to have a rule of you can't video there, which is why it's audio only. Do you think that made it seem more intimate that it was audio only for people receiving it? Because there's this view of radio and podcasts seeming more personal than visual.
Yeah, it's like you're eavesdropping in on a moment or a conversation or something like that. But yeah, quite possibly that added to that. I just also think there's so much in the material that is relatable that most people have gone through or somebody they care about has gone through, from yeah, illness and death and loss of love, and it's just oddly relatable, very as unrelatable as having all of those things happen at one time is. All of the different pieces of it are so relatable.
It completely is, and I wasn't going to mention it, but my mother had cancer and fortunately survived. But hearing your special around that same time, I'm very grateful for what you created, and I'm one of the millions that found it not only very, very funny, but very important and affecting.
Well, thank you. And you said your mother's okay now?
She is okay now.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But thank you for creating such a just a phenomenal work of art.
Well, it was almost accidental, but
Sure.
thank you.
With the success of that audio special, that accidental special, as it kind of was,
Yeah.
you go into this in the again, excellent documentary. It's almost the definition of difficult second album, of how you match that level of success with the follow-up. And I remember scenes of you going into clubs and going like, "Can I work out five? Can I work out a 10-minute set?" And being
Yeah.
introduced as, "Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have your minds blown. This is the greatest comedy performance you'll ever see in your life. Please put your hands together." And you're going, "No, please don't set me up like that. I cannot live up to that."
Yeah.
How do you persevere through having, and in your own words, you had nothing. You had sort of scraps of ideas that you were trying out. But how do you persevere to build the second album from that? And it's something that is, I think, relatable to a lot of people, particularly artists and particularly comedians. How do you rebuild momentum and match a sort of, when you've reached a real peak, how do you then continue that or rematch that, if that makes sense?
I don't know. I don't know if you there's no guarantee to match or surpass that. And I think that everything I've always done has been what genuinely feels good to me at the moment. And I was always, as a kid, a major risk taker in not great ways. And I feel like becoming a stand-up comedian, I've been able to kind of focus that risk-taking element to my personality and use it for good. And I think that that's just what I've always done in comedy and life, is like take these crazy risks. Or it's very similar to just doing weird bits or anything in life to see. It's like bl dyeing potatoes blue, all the way to taking my shirt off on stage with double mastectomy scars. It's like you want to see how people respond, and that's just been in my DNA my whole life. And so I guess I always assumed I would never match or surpass what happened with my album called Live. That ended up being the number one selling comedy album of the year around the world. And so I never expected that. I never dreamed of that. And so when that happened, my mind was blown, but I just kind of continued on and just wanted to get back to what is going to make me happy, what's going to amuse me. And after my surgery, what was going to amuse me was to go on stage with my shirt off and not talk about it. And so I don't know. I feel like there's been a pattern my whole life, you know?
Totally, totally.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that set I think it's from, is it Boyish Girl Interrupted, that one?
Yeah, that's one of my HBO specials. And that's what followed Live, the album where I said that I had cancer.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned that because you did an interview for on Fresh Air a few years ago, and talked about that bit. And I thought it, the answer you gave to the question summarized, I think, just a great your great creative instinct and your great sort of artistic instinct, which is in reference to that bit. I didn't want it to just be this intense or poignant moment. I wanted it to be funny. So I wanted to make sure that I followed up with not just jokes, but hacky jokes. And a lot of people consider airline jokes hacky. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go on under air travel with my shirt off. And that instinctual, I've got to juxtapose this from the incredibly substantial and deep to the almost painfully skin deep and sort of prima facie style, is that sort of does that relate to the ridiculousness, or is it a love of like combining two elements? Is it an element? Do you get sort of joy of like sort of combining opposites in some way, or that sort of natural juxtaposition?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely joy in that. And it's just it's a very tricky line to walk because, you know, I don't go on stage with my shirt off. I take my shirt off mid-show. And so things are going well, and I'm very aware that it could shift because the slightest thing can rearrange the entire vibe of a room. And so that's also the excitement of it, is to see if I can keep everything under control as I take my shirt off and reveal scars across my chest. But yeah, I knew that obviously a cancer diagnosis can be very serious and scary, and having such a massive surgery like that is serious and scary. But I felt like the most effective way to present that topic, that discussion, was to, you know, how they say it's best to show, don't tell.
Sure.
I just thought that was a perfect opportunity to show and not tell. And I just also thought the ridiculousness of talking about airline travel
Yeah.
while my shirt was off was the best way to do it, because I don't think anyone could say I was hacky
Yeah.
taking my shirt off, but somebody could say I was hacky talking about that material, and it just really excited me to combine those two.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It was the perfect way to, as you say, show, don't tell, and sort of make statement without making a statement. Just
Yeah,
yeah.
without stopping the show to preach about anything, or just to show people this happened, I healed, I'm doing all right, and it's just my body. And that's what I tell everybody, is the I was so scared of my scars. I was so scared of what my body would look like, and now I just think in terms of the scars just show that my body healed. There's nothing. I always use the example of if somebody had a huge scar across their face, people wouldn't say cover that up, you know. It's just, and so what? Because it's 6 inches lower than my face, it's like, oh my God. Oh my, it's like the scar could be anywhere. Who cares?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yes, and you must have had tremendous amount of feedback of people being grateful more than anything of if she can do that, then I can feel comfortable with mine. Have you received
Yeah.
that kind of feedback and praise?
Oh yeah, I definitely heard that. In fact, I remember I tried it out at Largo before I did my special. I did it a couple of times. I did it once at Largo, I did it once in New York. The comedian Bo Burnham was at Largo on my show. It was the first time I had done it, and I took my shirt off, did my set, and then when I went backstage, I remember Bo saying like, "Oh my God." He was like, "This is beyond just even cancer or women's body issues." He was like, "This is just he was like, I'm a man that hasn't had cancer, and this is inspiring me and making me realize like these are our bodies. What is the problem, you know?" And so that was a really fun element, was hearing from people that are male or don't have cancer, and just making them think in terms of just what it means to them.
Yeah.
And that was an element I didn't even think about.
Yeah, it does always surprise me that it's often in the hyper specific people find sort of universality and yeah, no, I can totally relate to equally being a male without cancer, finding it inspiring.
Well,
What
thanks.
you have such a strong connection with Largo. What about Largo so appeals to you? What why do you, it's because in many ways it sort of seems like your comedic home, or certainly one of them. What about that venue do you so like?
I mean, I've been performing there for, I mean, probably, I guess, maybe 15 years or so. No, 20 years. I think I've been performing there. And I came in as a guest of different comedians on their own shows before I got my own show. And the audiences were just so ready to go. They were ready to just devour whatever you were gonna try out. And it's, yeah, just the environment is so like nothing else. I mean, it's the first place I went when I came back from my tour overseas and tried out this new chunk of 45 minutes that I have no idea how it's going to go. And but that's that comfort of, like you said, a home. It's I would say 1,000,000% my comedy home.
That's wonderful. You write on stage, which is I know a lot of comedians do that. Why? But it's sort of somewhat surprising to me. What is it about only being on stage that enables you to? You mentioned before then something about the vibe of the room. Is it to do with the vibe? Are you checking the vibe as you're writing it? And what do you? What is it about being on stage writing as opposed to sitting at a desk writing?
Well, I feel like you can just jump over step two, you know, and just go from, I have an idea. I'm not going to write it down. I'm just going to go straight to the stage and see what people think and how I feel. And it's probably also, to be very honest, the lazy part of me that's a terrible student, because I don't want to sit down and write. And I just want to see something and then make a mental note of, oh, that's really funny. Let me see if I can make that translate on stage. And so I just like to skip right to the stage.
I did wonder whether it was sort of a way of because you can't procrastinate on stage also.
No.
You've gotta come up with something now.
It's very fight or flight. And there are times where I go on stage just absolutely without any, I mean, that's how I do it. No direction, no punchline. And I just have to kind of fumble my way through it. And I'm always surprised what comes out of my mouth. And I'm like, where did that come from? It's really something.
It's also a very brave thing to do, to be effectively dropped into a maze that's covered in fog. and tell yourself you have to find the way out every time.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it feel a courageous thing or brave in that way, or is it more just, I don't know how else to do this?
Yeah, I don't know how else to do this. It's, you know, and it's also something I've done for, I think I've been doing stand-up for 28 years. And when people use the word brave with even comedy or doing comedy without punchlines or anything thought out, I feel like that is from somebody that's not a stand-up or, you know, because when I look at anybody doing any job other than what I do, that is massive bravery, because I'm like, I put myself in somebody else's shoes and I'm like, oh God, I can't do that. Oh my God. Oh my God. I don't ever want to do somebody else's job.
Yeah.
That is the bravest thing I've ever seen anyone do.
Yeah.
Even if it's like driving an Uber, I'm like, oh my God. I mean, that actually can be.
No, genuinely, you found one of the bravest.
Yeah, that is actually pretty brave. But yeah, I think it's just a matter of settling into and feeling good in what you do.
Mm. I agree. You've acted in TV and film a lot. It seems less so in terms of theatre acting, unless I'm mistaken. Does that appeal to you? The way you said no would suggest perhaps not.
I'm open to it. In fact, I was approached to they were opening that play Chicago on Broadway.
Okay.
And Pamela Anderson was playing Roxy.
Okay.
And they wanted me to play the guy, whatever his name is, Billy whatever, that
I watched it for the first time a few days ago, and I also wish I could remember the name right now.
Yeah, it's what's his name who played it in the movie.
Oh, well, Richard Gere.
Yeah. And I was so excited. I thought, oh my God, this is such a crazy opportunity. I would love to do that. And they were offering to help me with dance and singing lessons. Because I was saying, I don't really dance and I can't sing. And they were like, that's okay. We could if you can carry a tune somewhat, we can get you lessons. And this character's singing is kind of like that talk singing.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is a massive musical fan. And so when I was considering doing this, she said, you know, if you do this, if you take this job, you have to do it 1,000,000%. You cannot walk out half-assed or like winking at the audience, like tongue in cheek in any way. Mm. You have to really own it. And when she said that, I thought, even though I wanted to do it 100%, I was just so busy in my schedule. And it was really just to open the play for X amount of time, a month or two, I don't know. And then they would have somebody else come in. But I just thought, if I had more time to prepare and I knew this was an option, then I would have taken the singing and dancing classes and I would have given it my all. But I didn't feel like I had enough time to prepare. And if I would have walked out knowing I wasn't fully prepared, I wouldn't have been able to keep a straight face, because I would have been having a look on my face like I'm caught. Yeah, I'm not prepared for this. But I haven't really ever, I did a small play in Los Angeles in 2011, maybe. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that is when it was, 2011. But yeah, I'm not a trained actor. That's not my world. But it's become my world that I am acting, but it's, I just like to make sure people know that I am not a technical actor.
Sure. I'm now bitterly disappointed we've not seen the Tig version of Both Reached for the Gun.
Yeah.
I hope that, well, it sounds like you're still, it's still of interest to you.
Sure.
The hope is
Sure.
still burning.
Yeah.
Would you prefer musical or straight play if you were given a 50-50 choice?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I would do better at just without a musical, but I also think how fun to push myself to see if I could actually do that.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't think I'm gonna end up in either of those situations,
Well,
but
let's not write it off straight away. There's
okay.
still, I think there's a big audience would be making those Broadway tickets skyrocket within seconds.
Okay.
Do you, returning to comedy, do you remember the first laugh you got and slash or the first joke you wrote?
The first that I wrote was it was a story about a friend of mine from growing up was in a band that was coming on tour to Colorado, where I was living at the time. And he said, "Here's the road manager's number. Call him to get tickets for the show." So I did. I said, "Hey, my name's Tig. I'm a friend of Johnny's," and blah, 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 told me to call for tickets. And then the road manager said, "Okay, well, I don't feel real comfortable calling you this, but I guess I'll see you tonight, Pig." And I said, "Oh, I actually don't feel comfortable with you calling me that either. I said, my name is actually Tig." And he said, "Yeah, that's what I said, Pig." And I said, "No, it's Tig with a T." And he said, "Tit?" And I said, and then the punchline that I wrote, because all of that is true up to that point, and then the punchline I wrote is just like, "Yeah, that's right, it's Pig Tit." And so when I first started doing comedy, that was one of my first stories that I would tell, and all of my comedy friends used to call me Pig Tit. But yeah, I performed for the first time at a coffee shop in West Hollywood in Los Angeles, and that was the first laugh I got was with that story.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you watch a lot of documentaries and you also listen to a lot of country music. Do you watch comedy specials? Or is it very much
No.
like, oh, that's The Office, I don't want to relax with, not the sitcom to
Yeah.
clarify, the play.
Yeah, there has to be something. It usually comes from Stephanie where she'll say, "Oh, so and so has a new comedy special. Would you want to watch that with me?" And it's pretty hit or miss if I say yes to that.
Sure.
Yeah. I like I'm not really into comedy shows or movies either, unless they're very dark or twisted or weird somehow. I like dramatic and devastating. That's what I'm into.
So you want total opposite to switch off and go the far extreme. Well, I think you've referred to such as a documentary nut. You're a big documentary fan. What was it like then being the subject of a documentary and for such fly on the wall, such a close personal film, with Tig the documentary? How was that experience to be the subject of one?
Well, it's certainly a an experience that you can't understand until you're in it, because I think when you think, "Oh, do you want to do a documentary?" "Oh, yeah, that'd be great," because you're thinking of the final product. And then you don't really realize what it's going to be like to be in your day to day and having, not that they weren't with me 24/7, but they were certainly in my life for a good year. And It went well, but it was hard because I had just come through this really hard time in my life, and in my mind, I thought, well, this will be easy. They'll just capture me in my just like at my best and through it all. And they did, but it was also hard to get on stage. They were capturing bad moments on stage. They were capturing me awkwardly falling in love with the person I was going to marry. And she wasn't at the beginning wanting to be on camera in a documentary. And then there was also just health stuff up and down and trying to have a child. It's just all of the things that it's embarrassing to admit, but I did think after I went through everything in 2012 that life was gonna just be a breeze from there on out, just smooth sailing. And because I thought I got everything out of my system. And then it's the reminder of, oh, right, life continues no matter what you go through in life. You will continue to have huge highs and huge lows, and you don't get anything out of your system. I'm glad we did it. I would never do it again. But I'm actually currently, we haven't announced this, and I can't yet. But I'm actually producing a documentary right now for an old friend of mine, and we're working with the filmmakers that did the Pamela documentary. And yeah, like they did the Keepers docuseries, they did the Dr. Ruth documentary. They've done, they're so tremendous, and I feel endlessly thankful that they've taken on this project because it didn't, it's one of those things that you call and you pitch to do. I was pitching it to different producers, directors, and financiers, and it's really a matter of you need to do a deep dive on this person, and then that's what's going to sell it. And they called, like 3 days later, and flew immediately to start filming my friend. So yeah, it's massive. It's massive. But I'm very excited. It's a heavy project, but I feel very lucky to be able to do this and to be working with the team that we're working with, because it's, like I said, it's heavy.
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
You should be. I can tell it's already really phenomenal.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Do you know when it will be announced? When will we know what you're talking about?
I would imagine we're doing it independently. We made a conscious decision to keep this internal and just make the film. And then it's
That's creative autonomy.
very primed for festivals. And so that is, I can guarantee you it's going to be at festivals. So I can guarantee it. So that's when you'll probably hear about it, is maybe in the early new year or end of this year. I'm not quite sure though. I'm not quite sure yet.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So sorry I can't give more details than that, but
No, that's okay. Hopefully you might even come back on the show to talk about it when you're able to,
Right, yeah.
when it's out, because it sounds fantastic. And clearly with someone so passionate about the medium to be making it,
Yeah.
who's
Yes.
had the spotlight on her to then
I'll tell you what, when this idea came about, I haven't felt this ignited by a project in a long time.
Oh, you're very good at pitching this project
It's
that I still
true.
don't
It's
know anything
true.
about.
Every cell in my body is telling you the truth.
Incredible. I've
Yeah.
never been more excited to watch the I don't know what is.
Well, you mark my words. You mark my words.
I will do.
Yeah, that it's good.
Fantastic. I'm genuinely excited. I'm genuinely excited. Well, I could happily talk for longer, but I won't keep you in this hostage situation for much longer. I'd love to end with a couple more questions. We'll do two more questions, which is one is,
okay.
What is a particular ambition you've yet to achieve? Maybe career or wider than that, but what's something, I mean, we've spoken about sort of, you know, Chicago, but is there something you go like, I at some point would love to do that, or I'd love to have tried that?
Well, my wife, Stephanie, makes fun of me because everything I talk about wanting to do, she turned to me one day and said, it sounds like you want to retire. and I laugh so hard because everything I talk about is I want to keep learning how to cook things that are my favorite meals that I taste when I go out to eat or to a friend's house. I want to learn how to garden.
Right. And
I also am interested to learn to golf. And so she was like, you are, it sounds like you want to retire. But yeah, I think my career, I don't have any other hopes and dreams. It's surpassed anything I've ever, ever, ever imagined. So I think it's more personal of my interests in my day-to-day and life with my family. I would love to be gardening and cooking what I'm gardening and then head out and head off to a golf lesson. That just sounds like a dream. A dream.
Stephanie sounds correct in that ultimate ambition.
Yeah.
There's a British sitcom called The Good Life. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it is basically, imagine a 1970s version of your dream. So it's a couple who become self-sufficient. They grow food in the garden, they cook the food, and it's all of that. It's not gritty. It's not a political thriller. It's not a documentary, but it sounds like...
Right up my alley.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying, you know, I podcast as well. And that's kind of, I started podcasting in 2005. And I'm on my fourth podcast. Mm-hmm. It's called Handsome. And it's with me and Fortune Feimster and Mae Martin. And it's just utter nonsense. It's ridiculousness. It's so fun. And that was a dream of mine to shut down all of the other podcasts, just focus on one and just go for it with silliness. And I'm doing it and it's making me very happy. It's an easy lift every week.
And it's a very easy listen. I'm a big fan of Handsome.
Oh, well, thank you.
And it does have a sort of full circle, or at least continuation of this love of the silliness and the whimsy and the ridiculousness. And it is a very joyful, very just it is a fantastically fun podcast.
Thank you.
It seems no sign of slowing down. I certainly hope it runs for a while yet.
Me as well.
Sure. Okay, my ultimate question then is one I ask every guest who comes on the podcast, which is quite simply, why do we need stories?
Why do we need stories? I mean, I think like we talked about earlier, it's just, it's such a boring answer, but connecting people. I mean, even, you know, I always joke about that I love to tell boring stories and I tell them to my children at night and it's so cute because they call me Mare. They'll be like, Mare, can you come in my room and tell me a boring story tonight? And I just pick out some random story from my day or my life and I just tell that to them and hopes that they get to know me better or hopes that they can see themselves in my little boring story or think about something a little differently. And I call it boring story because I don't ever sit down. Well, kind of like on stage, I don't ever sit down with an idea. I just make myself roll through memories in my head, whether it was that afternoon or when I was 7 and just tell him anything. And it's such a nice way to end my day, connecting with my kids with just simple, boring stories.
Well, the stories that that you've shared have been anything but boring. And
well, thanks.
Thank you again for the art you've created, the incredible progressing comedy. You've moved the art form on leaps and bounds, almost special after special.
Well, thanks.
And the connection and sense of connection you've given to people at every possible point in their lives. So, Tig, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Hopefully I'll see you next time I'm over your way.